Thank you for listening, and welcome to the Titans of History series. Episode 44, Portugal Part 2, Wellesley Arrives. Welcome back, everyone, and I hope you all enjoyed our Part 2 of Spain during the opening phase of the Peninsular War, as we broke down many of the early battles at the start of the conventional warfare, finishing off, of course, with the catastrophic French loss at the Battle of Bailen, a battle which broke Napoleon's seemingly endless cloud of invincibility, instilling in the Spanish, as well as all of Europe, a sense of confidence that the French Emperor could finally be defeated in battle. Now, today, we're going to dive into the reverberations that Bailen caused across the European geopolitical landscape, what it meant for Napoleon's fortunes in Spain, spoiler alert, they weren't great, what Napoleon was going to do to respond to this personal affront on his imperial honor, and introduce a man who is going to be a pivotal figure in our series for, well, much of what is left of it, Sir Arthur Wellesley, the first Duke of Wellington. But before we do, we need to tie up a few loose ends regarding the remainder of the Spanish uprising campaign. The week after Bailen, as the news of the result was making its rounds throughout the continent, General Duhamel was making his way back to Girona to try and reconquer the city after having failed to do so 3 weeks before Bailen. So, let's go over the second siege of Girona quickly, because it would be the last formal engagement before the French began their retreat back across the Ebro River in early August. Now, as we mentioned in our last episode, Girona was of critical importance to maintaining the French lines of communication from France through to Barcelona and Catalonia. After Duhamel failed to storm the city, he regrouped and prepared for a formal siege of the town, hoping to break its will and submit it via brutal attrition. Now, Duhamel had learned of the French defeat at Bailen only days earlier, but virtually cut off from the rest of the Grande Armée, he acted independently and decided to make a run for the city anyway. After all, Bailen was so far away from Catalonia, he figured it didn't really affect his position anyway, regardless of how big the psychological aspect of the victory was for Spain and her allies abroad. If anything, Duhamel was hoping that maybe a victory as Girona could swing the tide back in the French favor. But for the second time that summer, Duhamel's victory would be denied by the ferocious Spanish resilience and Duhamel's own isolated position. Approaching Girona on July 24th with some 13,000 men and nearly 300 guns, Duhamel set up a siege operation and began bombarding the city the same day. Now, Duhamel expected stiff resistance, determined not to underestimate the Catalans like he did weeks earlier, but even he was surprised at how long they would hold out. British Colonel Richard O'Donovan, fighting on behalf of the Spanish, led the city's defense as head of the Ordonia Regiment. Having fought in the Revolutionary Wars, he was predisposed to French tactics, and they were able to withstand and even subdue the French guns for nearly a month. As such, with shriveling ammunition, food, and being in an isolated position, which was made worse by the French retreat earlier in August, something which we'll talk about in a moment, Duhamel was ripe for the picking. Now, being isolated, Duhamel's rear was exposed the entire time during the siege. The Catalans had sent word to assist in lifting it, and it was Count Raimado Caldagas who heeded the call. Leaving Martorell in central Catalonia on August 6th, he arrived at Girona on the 13th with an additional 3,000 men. Setting up attack positions all around the city, the Spanish sent about 1,500 troops on August 16th from the French rear, who surprised Duhamel's men. Surrounded, he ordered another retreat back to Barcelona, where his men were harassed by guerrilla fighters the entire time, as well as British cannons from the coast. Now, they would eventually lose all their guns and much of their morale, but they would make it back to Barcelona with minimal human losses. Nevertheless, with Bailen having played out the previous month, and with the French now beginning their mass retreat back near the French border, the situation on the ground had changed considerably. And with that, it is, finally, time to introduce Sir Arthur Wellesley, the first Duke of Wellington. Now, as a full disclosure, I did want to dedicate this episode today to Wellington, much like I did one for Horatio Nelson prior to the War of the Third Coalition. But I did sign off last week saying that we would finish up the summer of 1808 and then get back to Portugal. So we're going to do that today. However, and spoiler alert, next week I am going to do a full supplemental episode on Wellington up to his invasion of Portugal in August of 1808, which will help us set the stage for the next 7 years in which he is going to be a mighty big thorn in Napoleon Bonaparte's side. So we'll just roll with the punches for this episode and truly dedicate some time to a man who also deserves his own series in our next episode. Okay, so with that, back to the show. Sir Arthur Wellesley, the first Duke of Wellington, was, by 1808, on his way to a meteoric rise through the British Army ranks. Born only 4 months before Napoleon on May 1, 1769, he had become a lieutenant general at the age of 38 in April of 1808, just days away from his 39th birthday. Now, at the time, the British Parliament was still debating as to how they wanted to handle the situation down in the Iberian Peninsula. Originally, they had wanted to send Wellesley down to Latin America to help disrupt the Spanish trade, as well as to assist Venezuelan revolutionary Francisco de Miranda in overthrowing the Spanish colonial rule there. But after the Dos de Mayo uprising, the situation completely changed, and Britain now found itself on the same side with their former rival of Spain. Coupling this with the pleas of their longtime ally Portugal, Parliament sent new orders to Wellesley, instructing him now to land in Portugal, recapture the country from Junot's isolated French forces, and then rendezvous with the 5,000-strong British garrison at Gibraltar, from which they would launch a greater campaign into Spain. Setting sail from the continent with 9,000 men, he left Cork, Ireland in July of 1808, arriving in early August. From here, Wellesley would enter the book of history as one of its finest military officers. Now, as a quick aside, I am going to be referring to Wellesley as, well, Wellesley for the next few episodes because he wouldn't be made Duke of Wellington until the following August of 1809. It's sort of a similar naming convention employed when discussing Caesar Augustus. He was called Gaius amongst his closest associates, Octavian up to becoming Princeps by historians, and then Augustus afterward. Again, even though he likely never used the title during his lifetime in social settings or otherwise. So, if anyone was wondering why Wellesley instead of Wellington, well, now you know. And so, with that little aside out of the way, let's get back to Sir Arthur Wellesley. Now, the British plan was simple enough. Defeat Junot's army in Portugal, recapture the country, and then use it as a launching pad from which to hem in the French and Spain. Having access to the Portuguese ports on the Atlantic coast were of critical importance. Being able to continuously ferry in fresh troops from Britain, as well as elsewhere, and also to have a stable base for their supply lines. But we haven't talked about Portugal much over the previous two episodes, given all that was going on in Spain, so we should do a quick recap of what was happening across the border while the British mounted their armada to help liberate the country. Now, backing up to December of 1807, Portuguese resistance had been largely subdued, mostly in part to the fact that large swaths of her former government and military leadership were now en route to Brazil to escape French capture. This left a population, which, like Spain's, was poor, illiterate, and staunchly conservative, unable to offer up much of a coordinated resistance. And while little rebellions did spring up, well, they were quickly crushed, and Napoleon ordered Junot to submit the country violently should they resist French governance. Now, initially, Junot had wanted to occupy Portugal peacefully, and he instructed his men to not pillage any of the cities from which they were stationed. But in January of 1808, Napoleon ordered Junot to begin seizing all of the assets of the Portuguese nobility who had fled to Brazil, and, if he was unable to do so, to levy heavy taxes on the population as a way to compensate for the difference. Now, because most of the noble refugees had brought the majority of hard specie with them to South America, the already poor population of Portugal were left devastated by the crippling taxes. However, this also greatly impacted the French occupation, because without any cash available, they were unable to support themselves, as paying for a foreign occupation is, well, expensive. And this was to be exacerbated come the spring, because the situation in Spain came to a fever pitch. Because by the Dos de Mayo uprising, the French had some 25,000 troops in Portugal, with an additional 15,000 Spanish allied troops stationed across the country. However, the situation changed dramatically once it became known that Napoleon's occupation of Spain was essentially a full-blown invasion, and those 15,000 allied troops soon became hostile combatants. Once the Spanish uprising got going in earnest throughout the summer, Junot initially lost all communication lines back to Paris, and he became a sitting duck in Lisbon. Many of his Spanish troops began to march back into Spain to help join the fight against the French. Porto, Portugal's second largest city, was, since December of 1807, under the command of Spanish generals. But once the news of the Dos de Mayo uprising had reached them, they seized the smaller garrison of French soldiers, turning on the men they had dined with only days before. And after about a week of contemplation, they marched north to Galicia to join the resistance, and Porto, a major shipping hub, was left completely unoccupied by the middle of June. Now back in Lisbon, 7,000 Spanish troops under the command of Italian-born General Juan Garrafa were quickly arrested by Junot, wanting to disarm them before they got word of Porto's defection. Junot then jailed the majority of them in prison ships in Lisbon's harbor, ordering his men to sink the ships should any of the Spaniards try and escape. By the end of June, Portugal's rural regions began to receive word of the goings-on in Spain, and soon they too were in revolt. The nightmare scenario for Napoleon had happened. The entire Iberian Peninsula was now in rebellion. Now, Junot himself was, even prior to all the rebelling, in a very difficult situation. Never mind the fact that the French were reviled in the country they were occupying, but Portugal's remote interior made communication difficult even when it wasn't being deliberately attacked. Now, Junot had Russian naval allies docked at Lisbon as well, but they were wary of the French after having just fought two brutal wars against them, and they refused to attack the Portuguese even if ordered to do so because they were not at war with Portugal. Furthermore, they also refused to fight for the French in what they deemed as their wars, so even if the ever-present Royal Navy decided to launch an invasion from Lisbon, the Russians said that they would only defend their own assets if attacked, not the French ones. On top of all this, Junot was ordered by Napoleon, the last such orders he would receive before his communication lines were completely cut off, to head for Badajoz and assist Bessières in Spain. Riots then began to break out in Porto, Lisbon, and in the Algarve. Now, Junot was able to dispatch small divisions to stomp them out, but his problem was that he couldn't be everywhere all at once. So, after conferring with his war council, the decision was made to defend central Portugal, abandoning the ideas of escaping to Spain, which was deemed too risky, and defending the north and south of the country, which was deemed basically impossible given their manpower and supply line situation. Junot ordered the fortresses around Lisbon to be restocked, and they were to be defended at any cost. After numerous skirmishes around the area and in the Alentejo, a vital region for its food supply, as it was the breadbasket and farmland of much of Portugal, by early July, much of the uprisings in Portugal had come to a lull. Nevertheless, the tension was such that it could have been cut by the dull end of a butter knife. But with much of Portugal now quiet, Junot decided to send out one of his best generals, Louis-Henri Loison, to the parish of Elvas in the Alentejo, which was on the border with Spain. Elvas held a strategic fort which was critical in funneling troops over to Spain, and Junot figured that it would be easier to get to now the fighting had calmed down across Portugal. So, Loison left Lisbon with about 7,000 troops, and he had anticipated that the fortress would fall to him without much of a fight, save for the few guerrillas he would need to fend off along the journey. Arriving at the provincial capital of Évora, however, Loison and his men found a large garrison of Portuguese and Spanish troops waiting for him. Now, all told, numbers, tactics, and coordination were all in favor of the French. Loison had around 7,000 men at his disposal to the Portuguese and Spanish 3,000, under the command of General Francisco Leite, widely considered to be one of the best Portuguese officers during the war, by the way. The French were also well coordinated, while the Spanish and Portuguese force, while highly motivated, was not, and Loison's men had been on hand in numerous battles, while the Portuguese and Spanish had little, if any, battle experience. And once Loison's men approached the city, the lack of experience showed in droves. Loison ordered a full-scale frontal assault on the poorly made-up Portuguese-Spanish line, crumbling it with near-flawless execution. The Portuguese and Spanish then broke back into Évora, but the walled city closed them in, and Loison ordered his men to give no quarter. Slaughtering soldiers and civilians alike, the French killed somewhere in the neighborhood of 2,000 to 2,500 people, all while ransacking the city for everything it had. The French would suffer only around 200 casualties, and they would be successful in their taking of the fort at Elvas. But almost as soon as Loison dismounted his horse at the city's gates, Junot ordered him to return to Lisbon at once. Why? Well, because Arthur Wellesley had finally arrived. Now, while the Battle of Évora was welcome news to Junot, he had little time to celebrate it, as only 2 days later, rumors were beginning to circulate that a British expeditionary force was en route to Portugal to help liberate the country. As it was, Wellesley, commanding the force as we mentioned, arrived on Portugal's shores on August 1st, though he was ordered to await additional reinforcements from Sweden and Gibraltar before attacking Juneau. The British Secretary of War, Robert Stuart, Viscount of Castlereagh, informed Wellesley that the French forces were well in excess of 25,000 men, and so he wanted to combine the numbers with the additional reinforcements to swell the British ranks to over 20,000 for a prolonged campaign. But Wellesley was ambitious, and he was hoping that Portugal would allow him to make an even bigger name for himself while he still held complete command of his army. Wellesley ordered his men to land at the mouth of the Mondego River at the city of Figueira da Foz. He believed it would be safer here than in Lisbon, where they would certainly be anchored under heavy fire, as many of the students from nearby Coimbra University had cleared the area of the few French troops, securing it for the British. However, the disembarking process was slow, and Wellesley's men, waiting for the additional reinforcements under Admiral Sir Charles Cotton, took a full week to get off the boats and prepare for the long march, which they began in earnest on August 10th. Now, when Junot received word of Wellesley's landing, he sent a division under the command of General Henri-François de Laborde north to harass the British, as well as to buy time for Junot to swell his ranks in anticipation of the larger British attack on Lisbon. Wellesley, for his part, was dealing with the stubborn Portuguese commanders over what was the fastest and most effective way to reach the capital city, but he eventually settled on the one which was closest to the coast so that they could keep their supply lines readily available if needed. After 4 days of marching and minor skirmishes, the two sides would meet at the small town of Rolissa on August 17th, the first engagement fought by the British Army during the Napoleonic Wars against the French directly. Now, even before the engagement began, the French were in an impossible situation. Outnumbered nearly 4-1 and with little forward momentum, the combined Anglo-Portuguese force moved to envelop the French by running distractions at the French center. De Laborde was wise to the maneuver, and he was able to pull his men back in good order, even forcing the British to make a fatal mistake by chasing him through a gully. This gave the French gunners time to inflict significant casualties on the British 29th Regiment, and De Laborde's men actually did a good job of holding their positions right through the afternoon. But eventually, the British numbers were too much to bear, and the French line eventually pulled back. Just after 4 p.m., De Laborde called for the retreat, and the French did so in good order, preventing a complete rout of his army by the British cavalry. They were able to successfully retreat to nearby Torres Vedras, though they suffered some 700 casualties to the British 500, most of which were in the 29th Regiment during the initial assault. While not the cleanest of victories, Wellesley had won his first engagement with the French, and the next day would head towards the coast to welcome an additional 5,000 reinforcements from Great Britain. This would allow De Laborde to escape, but Wellesley had bigger fish on his mind, Junot. And 4 days later, the two would meet at the decisive Battle of Vimiero. Now, after Wellesley rendezvoused with his reinforcements, the British occupied a position north of Lisbon near the small village of Vimiero. All told, his forces numbered just south of 20,000 men, including divisions of Portuguese soldiers under British command. Junot, meanwhile, had gotten word of Wellesley's preliminary movements and, seeing what the British were doing, marched up with 14,000 men of his own to meet him and ordered an attack on their positions at Vimiero. But once he saw that the British were occupying the nearby ridge, he ordered the attack to commence immediately instead of waiting for his flanks to develop. It was a mistake he would rue for the remainder of his career. The Battle of Vimiero can really be seen as a chess match in terms of forward positioning prior to the engagement. Both sides tried to outflank the other, all the while repositioning their troops to meet the other's moves. As a result, once the battle began, their initial moves were a series of uncoordinated attacks, mostly by Junot's forces. Junot sent skirmishers and artillery to support his main attack, but the British sent four companies to fight back, and they were able to repel the French advance and their skirmishers. It was a massive gamble by Junot that didn't pay off, and his whole vanguard was now left open to attack, which is exactly what happened. Exposed to Wellesley's guns and infantry, the French van buckled and was sent running to the rear. Another similar fate awaited a second French brigade, and Junot was then forced to send in his rearguard grenadiers. Now, while they were successful in breaking through to Vimiero under the command of General François de Kellerman, eventually British reinforcements would come to push them back as well. The British cavalry then attempted to rout Kellerman's unit, but inexperienced when compared to the French horsemen, the British cavalry was routed in turn, losing about one man in four. Even so, the French were too late in forming their lines, and the British, who were quick to replace their losses, repelled nearly every French advance. Junot ordered one final assault with his final brigade, but it too was pushed back. Signaling for the retreat, Wellesley ordered for his men to pursue the French, but Junot and his men were able to leave the battlefield, which we'll get into in a second. Nevertheless, the damage had been done, and the Battle of Umaidu effectively ended any hopes of the French maintaining a presence in Portugal. Suffering nearly 2,000 casualties to the British 800, the French invasion of the country was officially over. The Battle of Umaidu was exactly the kind of victory that Wellesley had needed to bolster his resume and show the British War Council that he could, in fact, be the leader of the British Army on the Iberian Peninsula. However, almost immediately after Umaidu, he was superseded in command by the arrivals of General Sir Harry Burrard, who served under British General William Howe during the American Revolutionary War, and Sir Hugh Dalrymple. Now, both men, who had seen relatively little battle experience prior to their postings in Portugal, were cautious men, wanting to create a quick peace instead of chasing down Junot and risk further violence. French General de Kellerman, knowing this, began engaging in truce talks with Dalrymple almost immediately, and as a result, Wellesley was ordered not to pursue the French. Now, this infuriated Wellesley, who believed that he could annihilate Junot's army in Portugal while also capturing the Torres Vedras forts across from Spain in order to further assist the Spanish resistance. However, not having official command, his hands were now tied. 9 days later, on August 30th, Junot met the British delegation at the Palace of Collouges in the civil parish of Sintra, just outside of Lisbon proper. There, they signed the Convention of Sintra, which gave Junot's army incredibly lenient terms, allowing them not only to return to France unharmed, but they would also be ferried off on British ships with all their supplies and the loot that they had stolen in Portugal. Thus, rather than eliminating them, the British basically granted pardon to some 21,000 French troops, shipping them off to Rochefort, France, and allowing them to fight another day, with many of them returning to do just that in the coming months. Junot himself was allowed to return to France, and he would arrive in early October, avoiding the heavy fighting in Spain by simply sailing around it. Wellesley, who was furious at the terms, reluctantly agreed to them, but he did not sign the convention, believing them to be a slap in the face of British military honor, and he would not be alone in that opinion. Now back in London, once the news of Umaidu and Sintra reached Parliament, outrage ensued. MPs, as well as the British public at large, believed the turns to be a disgrace, and Dalrymple, Burrard, and Wellesley were all recalled to London to face court-martials over the decision. For many in Britain, Sintra was seen almost as a victory for France, being let off the hook for what was a clear invasion of a foreign country without probable cause, while the British lost hundreds of her own soldiers to help liberate it. Now, Wellesley was eventually cleared, and he would be allowed to return to Portugal later that fall, but Dalrymple and Burrard were quickly whisked off into retirement, never to see command again as a result of the disaster. But we're going to leave Wellesley here for now and return to him next time as we dedicate that entire episode to him. And furthermore, we're also going to leave Portugal because while the British intervention in the Peninsular War would begin there, one of their major assists would come with the crucial evacuation of La Ramona's division in Denmark back to Spain. Wait, what? Yes, it is time for us to rewind and get us up to speed on Spanish troops stationed overseas who would prove critical to the eventual liberation of their country in the coming years. So, backing up to 1807 in the aftermath of the War of the Fourth Coalition, the Spanish, as we know, were still an ally of France. And given the situation in Northern Europe, Napoleon sent a large Spanish division to Denmark to help guard the northern flank against any further Prussian incursions. Now, the deployment was also seen as somewhat of a punishment for Spain, who Napoleon was still having deep suspicions about at the time. Commanding this division of 15,000 men, conveniently named the Division of the North, was Pedro Caro Sureda, 3rd Marquis of La Romana, and they were assigned to French Marshal Guillaume Brun's army. Now here, they would see action in the Siege of Stralsund, while also occupying towns throughout Swedish Pomerania, Mecklenburg, and eventually Denmark. And it wasn't Denmark in early of 1808, where La Romana's division would be transferred to Marshal Bernadotte's command, tasked with defending the crucial strategic shipping ports on the Baltic Sea from Royal Navy incursions. Also, because Napoleon was now beginning his occupation of Spain, he made sure that no Spanish unit was grouped closely with one another in case an uprising were to take place, believing this way, if any did happen, they could be stamped out quickly. Furthermore, once rumors began to trickle into the Spanish ranks of the uprisings back in their home country, Napoleon then bribed La Romana personally, as well as to offer prestigious awards to the soldiers who served him loyally. However, once the news of the Dos de Mayo uprising reached the Spaniards, there was no turning back. The infuriated soldiers began to send feelers out to the British in order to plan an escape back to Spain. Now, as it turned out, the British were more than happy to oblige, having tried to sway the Spanish units to their side ever since Napoleon launched his invasion of Portugal, warning them that Spain would likely be next on the docket. But getting to the Spanish was difficult, as Napoleon had secret police posted all across Europe. And so it would take a very special individual to be able to coordinate such an ambitious plan. But fortunately, Arthur Wellesley found such a man just before he departed for Portugal in July of 1808, a Scottish Catholic priest named James Robertson. Now, Robertson was educated in what is today Belgium and Germany, but he pledged his allegiance to the British crown after he feared what Napoleon's rule over Europe would do not only to the countries he conquered, but also the lasting impact it would have on the church. So, the British smuggled Robertson into Denmark disguised as a smuggler of cigars and chocolate, of all things, and he would eventually weasel his way around into getting into contact with La Romana because the Spanish actually, well, they really liked chocolate, so it was pretty easy. At first believing Robertson to be a French spy, La Romana eventually came around and agreed to any British plan which would get them out of Denmark to help them fight with their countrymen back in Spain. Once their commitment was assured, the Royal Navy ordered Commodore Richard Keats to make communications with La Romana's men, assuring them that they could evacuate up to 20,000 men with limited resources and with the utmost secrecy. Keats was responsible for the British fleet in the Baltic, and his knowledge of the ports in the region was vital to securing La Romana's escape. And as August approached, the final details were worked out, and the plan was ready to be put into motion. Now, La Romana was extremely careful in who he confided in to discuss the plans, as there were French spies everywhere, and even some of the generals in his war council were still, well, pro-French. This meant that he needed to get his orders out quickly, but did so in a matter-of-fact way, projecting them as French orders rather than ones that would raise any suspicions. Nevertheless, La Romana needed to concentrate the bulk of his forces in order for the escape to be successful, as speed was crucial for its execution. The plan itself was pretty simple, at least on paper. Concentrate his forces near the coast, seize the ports selected by the British, and board the vessels before the French could regroup and counterattack. But in order to do this without arousing suspicion, La Romana had to find a way in order to gather all those troops in close proximity to one another without raising any red flags. So, he decided on a plan of calling all of his troops together under the guise of a grand review by Marshal Bernadotte, and, when the signal was given, they would move in to seize the port. But just as he was about to put this into motion, an order came in directly from Spain that all Spanish soldiers needed to swear allegiance to the newly crowned king, Joseph Bonaparte. Now, while some of the soldiers did indeed swear their allegiance to Joseph, the garrison stationed in Zealand refused and broke out into a full-scale mutiny. While it was crushed, Bernadotte now became well aware of the danger he was facing by possibly having multiple Spanish garrisons stationed close to one another. He ordered the French and Danish troops to separate the Spanish garrisons and essentially encircle them so that they had no routes of escape. But before Bernadotte could put his plan into motion, La Romana received word that Keats' fleet was en route, meaning that the Spanish needed to execute their plan immediately. Sending scouts to the individual garrisons, the troops stationed on the island of Funen seized the port, overwhelming the little resistance they faced in the Dutch navy. The garrisons at Jutland then commandeered Danish vessels and sailed to Funen to rendezvous with the Spanish troops there, eventually totaling some 9,000 men. When Keats arrived, he ordered the seizure of an additional 60 smaller vessels to help transport the Spanish troops, after which they hit the open waters and sailed to Langolan to await larger troop transports that could withstand the long journey back to Spain. But by now, Bernadotte had, obviously, been alerted to the Spanish plans, and he sent a division west to stop them from escaping. Having already waited some 2 weeks and with no sight of the larger transport ships, Keats ordered the troops to reboard the smaller vessels and chart a shorter course to a friendly nation, which ended up being Sweden. They sailed for Gothenburg on August 23rd, just barely beating the French advance, and awaited their transports from there. The ships would arrive by early September, and by October, La Romana's division had been successfully repatriated to Spain, disembarking at Santander on the Cantabrian coast. The evacuation of La Romana's division was considered one of the great naval feats of the day, akin to a mini Dunkirk evacuation in the face of insurmountable odds with ever-changing logistics. The division would join the fighting almost immediately, joining the army of Galicia's 5th Division, just in time for Napoleon's all-out invasion of Spain, which we will get to next week. As for the few Spaniards that were unable to get ferried back to Spain, well, they would be some of the first casualties in Napoleon's invasion of Russia 4 years later, a punishment far worse than any likely imprisonment or execution they could have faced back in Denmark. But we need to talk about Napoleon, you know, the man who the series is actually about. Having returned to his retreat at Saint-Cloud in Paris in mid-September, Napoleon began to receive updates from across the front of what was going on in Spain, Portugal, and later Denmark. Hearing of Junot's surrender to the then-relatively unknown Wellesley, Napoleon scoffed, blaming Junot for the failure and vowing revenge. But he reserved the majority of his ire for Spain and her people, believing them now to be uncivilized backwater heathens who needed to be dealt with like spoiled children. And deal with them he would. Back in Paris, Napoleon ensured that the Senate would pass through an additional round of conscription to help raise another 120,000 troops. Knowing that the situation in Spain was far more dire than what he had originally envisioned, Napoleon moved to shore up his foreign alliances as well, particularly with Russia. So, in October of 1808, Napoleon trekked some 400 miles in 5 days to Erfurt, at the time a personal fiefdom of Napoleon following the Treaty of Tilsit, in which he would discuss the strengthening of the relationship with Russia and how to address not only Spain, but also the simmering Austrian threat, growing ever emboldened by the Spanish ulcer that Napoleon had created. But the Congress of Erfurt, as it would later be called, was far more famous for another reason. Because while Napoleon and Tsar Alexander began to discuss the strengthening of their tepid relationship, one Charles-Maurice de Talleyrand was working behind the scenes to secretly undermine Napoleon, and it was here, at Erfurt, where he would lay bare his true intentions of wanting to bring Napoleon down to his knees. And so in our next full episode, we'll address the Congress of Erfurt, Talleyrand, and the start of Napoleon's full-scale invasion of Spain.